From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From space satellite view, Manhattan's Central Park is striking for its sharp geometry, the great crisp rectangle in the middle of the nation's biggest city. On the ground, Central Park is striking for its curves and paths, its green and life, its stories. It's a year-round draw and a summertime superstar. This hour, On Point writers on Central Park. You can join the conversation. Have you seen it? Did you grow up in it? From the movies or from life, do we all have some kind of relationship with Central Park? What's yours? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York City is Andrew Blauner, editor of the new book, Central Park, an Anthology. It's 19 writers, Susan Cheever, Colson Whitehead, Adam Gopnik, Jonathan Safran Foer, and more, on Central Park. You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Andrew Blauner grew up and spent most of his adult life within a few blocks of the park. We've got a little tape of it behind us right here. A little bird sound and ambient life in Central Park in New York City. Andrew Blauner, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom. I confess that for an erstwhile jaded New Yorker, it's an absolute thrill to be here.
Erstwhile jaded. Well, we'll get you out in the park and take care of that. How far from the park did you grow up, Andrew?
Two blocks, and I spent from age six to 18, I was back and forth through the park, going from my home on the Upper East Side to the school I went to on the Upper West Side twice a day, 5 days a week, and spent many, many afternoons and nights and weekends in the park.
We will have listeners who, like you, grew up with the park as their kind of playground and walkway to school, and others who maybe only glimpsed it in the movies, for whom it's a very far away kind of notion. Just describe some of the dimensions of what we've got here, from 59th Street in the south to 110th in the north, and what's in between? Give us a kind of picture of the park.
Well, exactly. It's between 59th Street and 110th, as you said, bounded by 5th Avenue on one side and Central Park West on the other. And it's, as you mentioned, 843 acres, and there are some 38 million visitors each year. And it was opened in 1858. The critical moment, really, in the history of the park was the founding and the inception of the Central Park Conservancy in 1980, which is largely responsible for what we all love and enjoy about the park now.
Critical because things had gotten pretty raggedy there in New York's raggedy years in the 70s when crime was high. The park became a kind of no-go zone for a while. Goes all the way back to 1858. Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux won the design competition to expand on this area of Manhattan that wasn't so great for development, for construction, completed in 1873. And what about the topography of this park? Describe some of that for us, all the different kind of elements contained in this 843 acres, huge green rectangle right in the middle of Manhattan.
Well, that's the striking and phenomenal element that amid all of the concrete and all of the madness going on outside of it, there is all of these paradoxes that it's man-made nature, that it's where people go to relax and also to exercise, to meditate and to celebrate. And there are streams and trees and benches and fields. And Jonathan Safran Foer's piece in the book is called The Sixth Borough, and it really is almost a city unto itself.
We've got people, we're going to hear some of the wonderful writing you've got on this. We've got a lot of listeners writing in with their thoughts and memories already. Doug writes us, he's a Montanan. He says, in 1989, had an apartment in Manhattan, but was working for the state of Montana. And he had a Montana picnic in Central Park behind the Metropolitan Museum. Over 400 former Montanans attended. The junior fiddlers and children of all ages, the bus driver taking them around and down to the Empire State Building. But it is, in a way, a kind of the park of the nation. Even Montanans there celebrating in the middle of New York City, Andrew.
Well, exactly. I mean, you'll read or hear people say that it's the most important public space, not just in New York, but in the United States, and that it's even the greatest work of art of the 19th century. And it is of those 38 million visits each year, a great many of those are from people throughout the nation and throughout the world.
Give us a little reading here. Colson Whitehead contributed to your anthology. Some of these are written expressly for your collection. Others are taken from other work. His piece, I guess, was taken from the Colossus of New York. Great thing. And just so much of the feeling of Central Park in it. Could you introduce and read a little bit for us, Andrew?
Absolutely. And as you said, it's the book is a combination of pieces. The majority of the stories in the book were originally commissioned and are exclusive to the book. But there were some previously published work that was just too good to resist not to include. And I actually feel a bit like one of these all-star game managers where such an embarrassment of riches.
Yeah.
And Colson Whitehead's piece, a section of his piece goes this way. Where to sit? Where to sit? Our whole future depends on this choice. Strangers abound with their customs. A man and a woman pose on opposite benches, taking turns, catching each other looking. Such extravagant speculations from so little. So goes the romance of the park bench. No one makes a move. Under the sun, minutes expand until she gets up to leave. Wouldn't work out anyway. Shriveled men have determined that the average time spent on a park bench is 17 minutes, your tax dollars at work. In their green vehicles, the deputies of the Parks Department keep the peace. They know the best spots to get a little shut-eye when their bosses go out for lunch. Keep off the grass. This section closed. Scheduled to reopen 3 weeks ago yesterday. One girl uses chalk to sketch a hopscotch board. Another, the Virgin Mary. The rain will wash it all away from agnostic cement. Some ducks. He's definitely wearing the wrong shoes. Smile, everybody, smile. Watch out for horses and wake manure. Watch out for humans on conveyances. Trusted servants heave wheelchaired heiresses. Rollerblading yuppies burn off brunch. Always some jerk on a unicycle. A yogi demonstrates his amazing powers, and mimes on their day off expound endlessly. In the air, softballs shuttle, frisbees wobble, and epithets hurtle. Some things are more easily caught than others. This gang on skates explodes from the left and right of him and fly from him like sparks. So you lie, flat on your back, on the grass. Such a rich blue. What are you thinking about? Nothing.
Nothing, the privilege of thinking of nothing in the middle of New York City.
What a concept.
It just is fantastic. Colson Whitehead's piece from The Colossus of New York from Andrew Blauner's new anthology, Central Park. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And it's all about what Central Park means to New Yorkers and really maybe to the entire country. With us as well now from New York is Susan Cheever. She contributed the essay My Little Bit of Country to Central Park, an anthology. A prolific writer, daughter of John Cheever, who used to take her to the park, author of American Bloomsbury, Desire, My Name is Bill, and Home Before Dark. Susan Cheever, thanks so much for joining us today. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
It's just great to have you back with us. What does this park mean to New Yorkers? We'll look more broadly. It's in so many movies and so many books that the whole nation and world have consumed. But for New Yorkers, what does Central Park mean?
Well, I think it means many things. Reading this anthology has really shown me how many different things it means to many of us writers. It's sort of the heart of New York, but it's also, it seems to me, where everything happens. It's where you have your first date. It's where you have your first kiss. It's where you have, in my case, your first memory. It's where you take your children. It's where you go when you're older and you're kind of feeling a little bit rejected by the city. It really is the site of every important thing that happens in New York. And living near it is so important to me. I've never understood how people can live downtown so far from the park.
The movie makers tend to make it incredibly romantic. Are New Yorkers jaded to that? Or when you step into, you know, across that kind of low wall through one of the gates into the park, are you still in the realm of romance, Susan?
Yes, it still often takes my breath away. And of course, changes are made that are exceptionally beautiful. But in the spring, the cherry trees in the park are, I don't mean to be competitive, but they're certainly as amazing as the cherry trees in Washington. In the winter, the snowfall, there's a beautiful wrought iron fence now around the reservoir, which is where we all go to run, which makes the reservoir just one of the most extraordinary places in the entire city, because you can see the city sort of floating above the water on the other side of the reservoir. There's so many new and wonderful things, but because a lot of the park is about plants and trees and blossoms and flowers, it changes all the time.
Changes all the time, invites people in.
And continues to be romantic.
Yes, invites people in all the time. And then you've always got that contrast, Susan, between suddenly you're on a great meadow, but all around you, skyscrapers and the intense, intense bustle of Manhattan.
Isn't that the best?
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the role and allure of Central Park in America's biggest city, New York. A new anthology, Central Park, is out. 19 writers on their time, their thoughts, their loves, their losses, their New York lives in Central Park, with Andrew Blauner, who's editor of the new anthology, and Susan Cheever, wonderful writer who contributed My Little Bit of Country to the anthology, both with us today from New York City. We're going to hear as well from Thomas Beller, from Adam Gopnik, and we've got lots of listeners with their own Central Park thoughts and roots and resonance. Julie in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. Hi, Julie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I love this topic because I grew up in New York City in the 1960s, lived on West 70th Street between Central Park, well, between Amsterdam and Columbus. And what I loved so much about growing up near Central Park was that it was really my only exposure to nature as a child. And I think it's probably that way for a lot of kids who grow up in the city and don't get a chance to really get out very often.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me such an appreciation for nature that I wouldn't have had, and I mostly got taken to the playground, but I was always trying to wander off so that I could, you know, check out the trees and the grass, and all of that was just, you know, wonderful to have. I really appreciated that.
So the most urban of childhoods, but there, Central Park giving you that nature right in the middle of it all. Julie, I appreciate your call. Susan Cheever, this goes right to your theme. I mean, this is the way you like nature, kind of boxed up on a grand scale in the great flower box of Central Park.
Exactly. I was just going to say, listening to Julie, that if you think that's nature, it's going to be a horrible shock to you when you get out into what is really nature. But that's one of the beauties of the park, is that it's nature tamed, that it's nature without animals screaming in the night and deer eating your garden and all the other things that nature entails. And I'm not mentioning the ugliest ones, that it has all the beauty of nature with none of the nature red in tooth and claw stuff.
Susan, read us a little bit from your essay, if you'd be good enough. My Little Bit of Country, if you could introduce and give us a sense of what you've contributed here.
Okay, I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs.
Yeah.
I have depended on Central Park for its usefulness, but its incidental beauty has often taken my breath away. I may look up from catching the flash of a scarlet tanager out of the corner of my eye, a tanager perched in the high branches of one of the huge cherry trees on the west side, and my eyes hit the shimmering towers of Midtown, the Plaza Hotel and the General Motors building floating just above the sheep meadow. Sometimes while drifting in a creaky old rowboat rented for a trip on the lake, I follow a flock of fuzzy ducklings just a stone's throw from the blaring horns of Columbus Circle. It's the collision of man and nature, the collaboration of the human and the divine, that makes the most poignant landscape. The terracing of an Italian hillside, a garden trellis, the lighthouses off the New England coast. An ocean view is lovely but monotonous until a few boats appear. The sweep of green woods and mountain valleys in New Hampshire in the summer are catapulted into beauty by the white church spires rising above the green. Central Park is one of the most delicious of these collisions of man and nature. Here, the most intense city in the world is forcefully interrupted by some of the most glorious corridors of trees and abundant gardens in the United States.
And there it is, Susan Cheever reading from My Little Bit of Country, her essay in Central Park, an anthology. And that's it exactly, just cheek by jowl. We've got lots of response from our listeners, and maybe some tongue-in-cheek. But Nicola says, "Is my first trip to New York, I took a wrong turn in the park and had to survive off acorns for 2 days. Got invited to a stranger's wedding while I was there, though." Oh, well, okay. Melanie, the basis for my senior essay at Yale was 3 days spent tripping on acid in Central Park. Okay, all kinds of experiences here. Stefan, I was walking vaguely south to north through Central Park in 1998 when I came across a man in a blood-soaked dress shirt sitting on the grass with his back to a tree. He looked familiar. Then I noticed that the man standing over him looked very familiar. A helicopter swooped down from the east. The blood-soaked guy was James Caan. The other was Hugh Grant. I'd stumbled into the middle of the set of what turned out to be Mickey Blue Eyes. Yeah, it's always, Andrew, that kind of situation in Central Park where you're having your direct experience of it, but then we're also so accustomed to intermediated, you know, Hollywood experiences of Central Park, too.
Well, exactly. And that's why I come back to the paradoxes. It defines the city. It's you ask many New Yorkers what they love most about the city, and they'll mention Central Park, but what within the park? And you'll get probably no two answers alike. I think there've been over 300 movies filmed at some point in the park, rather.
Everybody's got their take on it, their way through it. Colson Whitehead writing there earlier that also on any given journey, the path you take will take you in very different directions. That kind of a mandala effect of the park. Nelson in Buffalo, New York. Nelson, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be on your show. I've got a question. It's a little bit on a darker side of human behavior. I was told once that the Irish helped build Central Park, and then after they built it, they were told to stay out of it. Is that true?
Hey, you've got me. I don't know if we have a history buff here in the park or not. Andrew, can you? I mean, it was built over many years. It was during a period where there was a lot of immigrant labor. I certainly wouldn't be surprised if there were Irish labor in it. It must have been. But
there must have been. I can't speak to that directly. There's a book by Sarah Cedar Miller, which has a terrific history and chronology. But of the 4,000 people that did help construct the park, I'm sure you're right about part of that population.
I did read that there was a time at which much or most of the traffic in the park was actually carriage traffic. Presumably, that meant, Susan, well-heeled people in the park. But today, it really is people's park. I mean, it's wide open.
I think it's always been wide open. You can tell people not to go in the park, but they go in the park anyway. It's. I don't think it's ever been in any way cut off from the avenues that surround it.
Christopher writes to us, it's important to realize that at the time Central Park was built, there was not so much city built up around the area. New York grew up around the park. Also, corrects me when you say Calvert Vaux, the co-creator with Frederick Law Olmsted there. Thank you for that, Christopher. I want to get another voice in here. Thomas Beller joins us right now from New York. His essay, Negative Space, is featured in Central Park and Anthologies. Co-founder of the literary magazine Open City, editor of the New York literary website Mr. Beller's Neighborhood. Thomas Beller, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Is Central Park part of your neighborhood, sir?
Yes, it is. It is now. Always has been.
Would you read for us from your contribution to the book? It's a wonderful kind of encapsulation of what the sort of high concept place of this park in this great metropolis.
All right. Well, the section you asked for is as follows. If you grow up in New York City, or maybe just Manhattan, as I did, you become a connoisseur of negative space. For hardcore city files, I mean the people who allow for the texture and topography of the city to enter their soul, these spaces are refuges, tiny oases, sought after, multi-purpose. They are meditative temples. They are moments of rest. There's so much action in New York, one is sometimes perversely excited by those places where you're not part of it, where nothing is happening. These places, in turn, become little air pockets of possibility. They are unidentified, off the grid, the staging areas for trysts, seductions, encounters. They are places where crimes are committed of one kind or another. The most conspicuous, hiding in plain sight negative space in New York is Central Park.
Thomas Beller, what's your sense of among New Yorkers? Do you have some who never set foot there, others who are there all the time? Is there a huge array, a range of interactions with the park, or is everybody kind of tethered there?
Well, I'm sure tons of people never set foot in it. If you read this book, you know, most of the pieces are by people who had some, you know, proximity to it. But one thing I do want to add, you know, to the celebratory note that's taking place, it is important to remember that, you know, the park is the setting for the whole range of human experience, much of which is really nasty or difficult or upsetting. And as many people who have beautiful experiences also have upsetting ones. And the tricky thing about that is that the upsetting ones are not entirely bad experiences. Sometimes they're actually quite formative or even, in, you know, kind of trophies of things you survived. So it's not just that it's this oasis of pleasure that you step into and everything is beautiful. I mean, just yesterday I happened to involve myself in this bizarre dog chase in which this woman was running through the great lawn screaming, "Help me, help me," as though she's being attacked. And then somehow she gasped out, like, "My dog is running away." And so a little team of Good Samaritans with, I guess, nothing better to do, ran after the dog. I happened to be on my bike with my kid. So we're racing after this dog. The dog is flying. I'm on my bike on these bike paths you're not supposed to be biking on, but now I feel very righteous because I'm chasing a dog. The dog ends up escaping. The woman is distraught. I take her number. I call later. Turns out the reason she's distraught is not that she's lost her cherished dog that she loves so much. It's that she runs a dog-watching company and has obviously, like, lost the prize
she's
been entrusted with.
Oh, no.
And, you know, that's just yesterday. So you ask about the New Yorkers, you know, do they interact with the park? You know, some do, some don't. But the thing to keep in mind while we're being so fond towards the park is all kinds of things happen there. Not all of them are good, but the not goodness of those things is often part of the character, I suppose, or the pleasure or the gift of the park.
Absolutely. I mean, Susan Cheever, there's red in tooth and claw goes everywhere life goes. I mean, you've got surely, you know, there's romance, but there's also the breakups and the grief and the just awkwardness, or especially back in the day, straight up violence in the park.
Well, certainly the human landscape of the park encompasses bad, good, all the things that human landscapes encompass everywhere. But one of the things I like about the park, the natural world of the park, is that it is cleaned up and tamed and made into a place of beauty and celebration. I mean, it's arranged for our benefit, for the benefit of human beings, you know, who see the way they see. So, of course, the minute you have human beings, you have complicated experiences. And that's a great story about the runaway dog.
The prize, but I do the prize think, poodle.
I do think the park itself is arranged in a way that's extremely positive. I'm not a huge fan of actual nature. Do you know nature outside of Central Park? I find it frightening. There are bugs. There are bears. You never know what's going to happen. Whereas in Central Park, you do know what's going to happen. I mean, to an extent.
Yeah, to an extent. We've got a listener here saying, yeah, you know, at a wedding in Central Park where a lot of raccoons showed up to share in their hors d'oeuvres. So you've got a little bit here. Let's hear a little bit more of that ambience from the park. Kind of a warm day, you know, wind in your hair, picnickers, that sound. This isn't the gasping dog walker looking for her prize poodle. Elliot in Alcalou, South Carolina. Elliot, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up in West 112th Street in New York City. My family migrated from South Carolina in the early 40s. I was about maybe 3-4 years old. We had a 6-room apartment for $50 a month or less.
All right.
And what I enjoyed mostly was in Central Park, they had a hill. They called it Dead Man Curve. and we would ride our bikes or skate down that hill. You could wind up doing 35, 40, 50 miles an hour around that hill from like 96th Street down to 110. And I enjoyed that so much, and the boating in Central Park. I had a wonderful childhood. We was poor and didn't even know it. I enjoyed myself very much in New York. And now I've moved back to South Carolina in 2005, which is I like South Carolina now.
Hey,
then South Carolina was kind of prejudiced, you know.
But yes, yes, indeed. But poor New York and didn't even know it, and thanks in no small part to Central Park. And, Elliot, I appreciate that. One more right here. Thank you, Elliot. New Orleans, Louisiana. Dick is calling. Dick, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi.
I just finished reading Bob Carroll's book on Moses, Robert Moses, and the couple of fights that he had over Central Park. One's a parking lot, and one was about the Shakespeare. And his reputation went down over those two fights. But I can remember going to Central Park and sitting online waiting for tickets to King Lear and eating a hot pastrami and drinking some Rheingold. And they ran out of tickets directly in front of me. And so we had to jump on the subway and go up to Yankee Stadium and watch Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris hit home runs over the right field fence.
Not such a bad trade-off, but a hot pastrami in King Lear, or nearly King Lear in Central Park. Dick in New Orleans, thanks for your call. Thomas Beller, I know we've just got you for a moment more. What do you want to convey to the world about Central Park?
Well, first I want to give a big wave to Dick in New Orleans, where I live for a good chunk of the year, and I'm constantly obsessing about the parallels between New Orleans and New York City. And the other thing I want to say about this book is when I got it, having just knowing only what I contributed, I really was surprised and fascinated by this, I think, somewhat unexpected subtext of the book, which is it's all about Central Park, but inevitably, certainly in my piece and a number of other of the original contributions, mm-hmm. it ends up being a book about childhood in New York. Yeah. And a particular sort of, there's a West, my piece has a sort of Upper West Side vibe. Someone like, I don't know, Jonathan Burnham Schwartz has a distinctly Upper East Side vibe. But there are these, which at the time was a much bigger difference than I think it is today. But it's an interesting subplot of the whole collection, which is it becomes, funnily, also a collection about childhood somehow.
Yeah, no question about it. With its rough edges and its glorious moments both in there, and you convey that wonderfully, Thomas Beller. Tom, thank you very much for joining us today.
Don't airbrush it. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Roll on the lawn and enjoy it. Thomas Beller, author of How to Be a Man, Scenes from a Protracted Childhood, and a contributor to Central Park, an anthology. Susan Cheever, please stand by. It's great to have you there. Andrew Blonner, editor of Central Park, an anthology. Listeners, you can join us. What's your great Central Park moment? Behind us right here, many concerts in Central Park. This is 1981, A Heart in New York, Simon and Garfunkel. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
New York, looking down on Central Park, where they say you're real enough to me, but there's a heart that lives in New York.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, sound of a carriage ride in New York's Central Park behind us right there. One of the pleasures of Central Park. There are many sweet ones. There are rough moments and rough history there as well. Many facets of the park, its physical beauty, its human life, and all kinds of rivulets in a new anthology called Central Park. Andrew Blauner is the editor. He's with us today from New York City, as is the wonderful writer Susan Cheever, author of My Name is Bill, Home Before Dark, Desire, and many more. She's contributed to the anthology. Adam Gopnik joins us in just a moment. Alex is with us from West Hartford, Connecticut right now. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, so I'm 25, going on 26, grew up in West Hartford, but have kind of been, had New York a part of my life, in and out for pretty much all my life, and more recently for the past 4 years was living in Upper Manhattan on the Upper West Side, and then for 2 years, and over on the Upper East Side for a little under 2 years.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for me, the most important thing in New York in general, not just parks, but it's just proximity. And that goes with, you know, friends, you know, for me, specific girls I'm dating, activities I'm doing. It's always about proximity. And, you know, it wasn't just, and coming from the suburbs, I gravitate towards anything that's not congested. And that's why kind of living in a place like Manhattan is a little bit ironic. But, you know, I would gravitate not just towards Central Park, but Riverside Park, really any piece of grass, you know, John Jay Park on the Upper East Side. A lot of people don't know that there's not just Central Park where you can find grass to kind of relax and clear space and just have some of your own time that you feel like you're escaping from the city. I mean, there's plenty of parks in New York outside of Central Park, and no matter what neighborhood you're in, I mean, they're all in some proximity where it's, you know, fairly easy to get to.
But that's the word, kind of, and the frisson, right? I mean, the wonder, Susan, you're right about it. Just the proximity really is it, that you've got this huge urban metropolis and then the other, that green other thing. You write in the summer, and you live just a couple blocks from it. In the summer, you write, we walked over to Bethesda Fountain to cool off. In the winter, mm-hmm. when the city air smelled of snow, we shouldered our skis, splintery slats of wood with huge coiling bindings, and slid shrieking with joy down the 79th Street Hill. And all that just, what, feet from New York City.
Exactly. Well, that's what makes it so dramatic. I think in New York, we all lead vertical lives. We're all on top of each other. And in the country and in Central Park, suddenly it goes horizontal.
Yeah.
So it's a huge change just in 10 feet.
Just stepping in. Adam Gopnik joins us right now. His piece, Through the Children's Gate, is one of the essays, pieces in the anthology. Longtime writer for The New Yorker, author of many books, including his most recent, The Table Comes First, France, Family, and the Meaning of Food. Adam Gopnik, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. It's good to hear your voice and wonderful to read you here. You came back with your family from France kind of on purpose, and getting your kids into Central Park and the whole New York thing was part of the reason why.
Absolutely. I write about that in the anthology. Should I read that little piece?
That'd be lovely, please.
All right. It's called Through the Children's Gate. We came back to New York from Paris in 2000 after years away to go through the Children's Gate and make a home here for good. The Children's Gate exists, and you really can go through it. It's the name for the entrance to Central Park at 76th Street and 5th Avenue. The names of the gates, hardly more than openings in the low stone wall describing the park, are among its more poetic, less familiar monuments. In a moment of oddly Ruskinian whimsy, Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux gave names to all the entrances of Central Park, calling them gates, each accommodating an imaginary class of person to enter there, a park for all the people with entrances for every kind. There was and is a miner's gate and a scholar's gate, and for a long time this was my favorite, a stranger's gate high on the west side. The Children's Gate is one of the lesser known, though I think the most inviting of all. And that's true, Tom, that yeah. all the entrances to Central Park, as I describe, are all called gates. And can I add something, Tom, because I think it's terribly important to clarify something about the political purposes of the park, because you hear these bizarre stories. Irish were not allowed to visit the park. Olmsted, the great maker of the park,
yes, sir.
Was a political reporter long before he ever designed a square inch of grass in any city in the world. And he became famous as one of the pioneering reporters for the New York Times because he went to the southern United States and he wrote a very famous book just before the American Civil War mm-hmm. about what was lacking in the American South from a purely cultural, from a civilizational point of view.
Okay.
And what he said was lacking was what he called, and this is a beautiful phrase that I think sums up the essential virtues of Central Park, it lacked, the South lacked, commonplace civilization. That is, the kinds of small, casual, amateur, intermediary relationships that give civilization its real tang.
Mm.
And he wanted Central Park to be a place where that kind of a commonplace civilization could happen. A retreat, a sylvan space within the city, absolutely. But even more, he wanted it to be that kind of a place. So two things have always been true. It's always been a park for the people. It's been open to the people, parsed and divided in all kinds of eccentric ways. But it's been a place where things like Shakespeare in the Park, where the chess players, where all of that kind of incredibly variegated activity that defines what a living democracy is could take place. Central Park has a very specific political program embedded in its design, and that's what it is.
Adam, let me ask you to do a little comparison then. I mean, we read that the park was a model for San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, because Olmsted active there too, Tokyo's Ueno Park. I've spent many great times there. Vancouver's Stanley Park, Youngstown's Mill Creek Park, Munich's English Garten. You spent all this time in France. Paris is famous for its public spaces. Are they commonplace civilizational spaces like Central Park? What's the difference?
They have been adapted to become that more and more as the years go by, but in essence and original purpose, no. Something like the Luxembourg Gardens, an absolutely beautiful place, began its life as the formal garden of a palace. And it still has, with enormous charm, it still has some of that kind of DNA, that imprint left on it. It's highly organized. It's a central LA that runs from north to south. You might notice, Tom, that Central Park has no central LA, no one grand avenue connecting one end of the park to the other. And Olmsted fought against it. There were a lot of people who wanted it to have that, insisted that a grand park had to have a grand boulevard, and Olmsted fought against it and refused to let it happen, exactly because he didn't want the park to have that kind of obvious hierarchical architectural structure. He wanted it to be centrifugal. He wanted it to be a place where lots of different kinds of activities could take place, and indeed they did. You know, one of the things that fascinates me is that in the winters in the 19th century, you would have, and I have checked this number, Tom, and it seems to be accurate, as many as 30,000 people coming in on a weekend just to go ice skating in the park. That's the kind of place it's designed to be, a place of that kind of democratic recreation.
Adam Gopnik. Susan Cheever, do you feel that democratic structure, that democracy-nurturing design, even today at work in the park?
Absolutely. I think the park, above all things, is open. It has all those gates with those lovely names,
yes.
But it's so easy to get into the park. In fact, it's almost impossible to stay away from the park. And, you know, when you go into the park, you see both the richest people in New York and the poorest people in New York together, you know, doing each, you know, living out their own lives, but within the confines of this relatively small space. So I think it's a brilliant democratic experiment. I didn't know that before. Thank you, Adam. And that it's still very much at work.
Nelson in Providence, Rhode Island is calling. Nelson, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. I happened to live in New York for a time in the 80s, and I was at the infamous Diana Ross concert, which you probably mentioned in your book, I'd imagine. You can buy the tape. If you remember, it was a monsoon hit in the middle of Diana Ross got up on stage and the skies broke.
Right,
and
seen the video.
And it was a riot, and she said everybody calm down, and people were freaking out and getting the electrocution, and then there was riots, and they developed a new word called wilding, that the people en masse went to the Tavern on the Green and wrought havoc and ran all through the city having riots, and they call it wilding from that incident. And it was so it was scary, and it was frightening, and it was pretty wild.
In the 70s and 80s, no question. We'll look a little bit more at that. Let me hold the thought, Nelson. One more, Danny in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Danny, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up about two blocks from Central Park, too, like a lot of the guests on the show. I think I went to school with Mr. Blauner. And also walked across the park to the same school, probably in the same time period. And I have great memories of growing up in Central Park in the 70s. One of the things that hasn't really been mentioned is the way the park has been fixed up in the past, I don't know, decade or two. When I was a kid, the park was pretty beat up. Mm-hmm. And I actually loved it that way. I learned a lot about botany from the various weeds that were growing in the field there. I feel like now Central Park is caged in so many places, and it is wonderful and beautiful, but it's a very different experience than it was back then. And I think that there is something that's been lost. I'd be curious to see what your guests have to say about that.
Let us pick it up. And thank you, Danny. Andrew, maybe you're a schoolmate there, so I'll put it first to you. I mean, my first, the Central Park was far from the prairie I grew up on, but of course we all read about it, we saw it in the movies, we thought about it, but my first experience of it was at a time when there was an air of well, you can call it freedom or menace around Central Park. Danny looks at the change, the cleaning.
Well, there's no question that it has changed. I respectfully disagree, maybe, with my former schoolmate that it's a bad thing. I think people look at places like Times Square and say it's become too commercialized and Disneyfied and sanitized, whereas by contrast, I think the park has retained, as I think Susan rightfully talks about and writes about, its wildness, sort of contained wildness, but still wild. And again, I have to come back to the Conservancy, and Doug Blonsky, who's the president of the Conservancy, and Adrian Bennett, he was the outgoing commissioner of New York City Parks and Recreation, and Ed Koch, and lots of others who were involved at the inception of the Conservancy, which again has played just a seminal role in making the park what it is today. And I guess I'm sympathetic to a little bit of nostalgia for the good old bad old days where it was a little rougher around the edges, literally and otherwise. But you know, I think it comes down to what Tom Beller was talking about in a lot of ways too. It's, you know, there's a scene in Kramer versus Kramer where the little boy is learning to ride his bike. That's where I learned to ride my bike. There's so much that's so Proustian about the whole experience, and that kind of transcends the changes that the park has undergone.
Mm. Adam, what about this? The park as a sort of cultural barometer. I mean, our callers remind us of, you know, Diana Ross and Monsoons and Wilding, and of course there's the famous jogger murder in 1989, and now a tidied up, much cleaner, safer park. Susan and her daughter run there in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I think, look, the park will always be a mirror of Manhattan. It's bound to be a mirror of Manhattan and indeed of the larger city, because it can't help but be that. It was designed to be that, and it will be that. When the city is in difficult times, the park will be in difficult times, and so on. I think it's ridiculous to be sentimental about the park in its decayed or decrepit state or when it was violent. These things are inherently wrong, and they're bad. They're very, very far removed from Olmsted's vision of what the park should be or what any sane person would want the park to be. People are capable of being sentimental about anything. People are capable of being sentimental about violence, apparently. Just to add about the whole issue of the Wilding and all of that, that was the kind of tabloid story that got way out of proportion. It happened once, but it was far, far, far from ever a dominant experience of the park. And I think that it's terrible when people exaggerate that part of things. You know, even the famous Wilding and the Central Park rape turned out finally not to be the act of some wild gang of feral youth running around, but the act of one and one alone very evil guy. So I think that we should try and dispense with myth and deal with the actual history and truth about the park.
Susan, your dad, John Cheever, and your folks eventually took you away from the park to the suburban life, but you were very determined to get your own children back in close proximity when you could. Why?
I was very disturbed when my parents moved us toward the better life in the suburbs and didn't like the suburbs at all, of course, real nature, and came back to the park as soon as I could and swore that I would not do that to my children. So I raised my children within a few blocks of the park, and I would think they would both tell you that that was a good thing. It gave them a quality of independence, and it gave them incredible things that rural children just can't have. I mean, instead of some, you know, mail order swing set, my children had these beautiful bronze animals to play on and these fanciful fountains and these incredible gardens. And I think that they both turned out pretty well.
A lot of magic in a mail order swing set, too. Blanche in Corinth, Vermont. Blanche, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, there's another part of the park. There's a part in the 1930s during the Depression where all the elementary schools were able to take whole classes to see anything going on. But our mother took us to Central Park at Sunday nights. We saw Leopold Stokowski, Bernstein, all kinds of music. I developed a great love of music. But mostly I remember Central Park for I Am American days, and that was right after the beginning, you know, the beginning of the Second World War.
What were those? What, patriotic rallies, or what was that, Blanche?
Oh, my God. I mean, yes, there were big rallies, and the mayor, sometimes it would be LaGuardia or Wagner, but they would stand up, and we would all recite the Pledge of Allegiance, and it was, and a lot of the, you know, great Sousa music was played. So it was a place that we all came together from New York City, and that's how I'll always think of Central Park.
Blanche, I so appreciate that memory. That's wonderful to think through that time. Adam Gopnik, here we go. We're in a new century now. Park's there, all cleaned up, ready to go. As Susan says, hedge fund guys and everybody else there together. New York has carried it forward pretty well here. It looks like it's standing the test of time.
The park has never been in as good shape as it is now, since its opening. The question always about the park is it was designed as a park for the people, and the kind of daily negotiation about coexistence, which is the essence of a great city, is argued out every day in Central Park, whether it's a kid with a boombox, largely gone now in the age of the earbud, families. How we share the park is how we share the city, and that will always be at stake there.
Adam Gopnik of the New Yorker magazine, he wrote the Through the Children's Gate essay for the new anthology, Central Park. Adam Gopnik, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Pleasure, Tom. Great to talk to you.
It's great to have you here. And Susan Cheever, it's always wonderful to talk to you. My Little Bit of Country, Susan Cheever's essay in the new anthology. Susan, thank you so much for your thoughts and reading today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Andrew Blauner, editor of the anthology, grew up by the park, and it's still very much on his mind. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Central Park, an anthology. Listeners, thanks for your memories, your moments. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.